message or book at the time the station breaks, so they'll know who they're listening to. Let's talk about it a little.
Oh, well.
You have a really good book. It's funny. Tell about the book.
Oh, well, that's connected, too. I came to Conspiracy out of innocence, yeah. out of false humility, because my book is called, it was originally called, going to be called, The Truth of Silly Putty, but the publisher, Putnam, the salesman there didn't know what that meant. I said, well, what the book was about, I said, why don't they read the book? But it wasn't their department. So they said, could you give us a subtitle? So I just gave them a subtitle, which was How a Satirical Editor Became a Yippie Conspirator in 10 Easy Years.
You know what? The title's so long that I'd send gifts to people, but I don't like to write out the title.
Uh-huh.
You've got to change it to Silly Putty. It takes so long to write the title, I can't even write the book to send the book order.
Well, that's the worst excuse I've ever heard.
Really? I'm short of time. We'll have to give it letters or something.
If you're really motivated, you'll do it.
I've been working too hard for the real.
I know. Anyway, that book got what was considered in the publishing industry really fine blurbs, you know, quotes from Joseph Heller, author of Catch-22, calling me a great American, from Groucho Marx saying the book is hilarious and I'm another Lenny Bruce. I mean, really fine quotes from Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and Ken Kesey and even John Lennon and Yoko Ono stuck a plug in for me.
Yeah, how long has the book been out?
Since last September. Now, what happened was it got reviewed virtually nowhere. And I thought at least the New York Times, since The Realist was the first underground paper, you know, you would expect the New York Times, and since it was by people in the literary world that praised it, I thought there would be a review in the Times. So I just wrote to the John Leonard from the New York Times, and who's book review editor, and got back a letter from him saying, we have a review of your book in the house, but I'm afraid it's not a good one. So I said, oh, that's too bad, but I still was looking forward to it. I was curious to see how it would be criticized. And then I met May, and I just mentioned that in passing, and she showed me, she got out her magic files, and there was a back issue of Computer and Automation, which had an article about John Leonard, who had...
It was about the Central Intelligence Agency and the New York Times and their role, right. Because I have many files besides a computer article on the control of Life magazine and the New York Times to keep the conspiracies from being told. They're definitely a part of the whole conspiratorial plot, their whole policy.
Well, what I learned from that was... because I wrote him a letter really trying, out of innocence, trying to understand, and I still was innocent. And then I found out indirectly from my publisher that the review of my book had been a very, very favorable one and that the writer had gotten paid for it. There's probably a name for that, the payoff, I suppose.
And then they put it on the shelf. That's called on the shelf.
There's on
a
the
step
shelf.
Down and on the shelf.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's happened a lot. I mean, yeah. Rolling Stone asked me to write a column for them once, and I wrote a thing, the first one, I said that would be of interest to our readers.
Yeah.
So I wrote a thing based on a book called Efficiency and Death, which is the participation of United States corporations in the manufacture and assembly of and loading of rocket devices into anti-personnel weapons used in Vietnam. And it was absolutely amazing to see that the companies that did it, you know, including radio stations,
yeah.
including
all part
you know, everything.
Of it.
Everything from Remington Shavers to General Motors are all involved in that, and also Honeywell, which is the biggest, which makes a lot of photographic equipment,
yeah.
and also Wurlitzer and Baldwin, which ordinarily they compete with each other, in not only pianos, but because they have other brand names like Gretsch, which is a big brand name in guitars.
But they're into weapons, too.
And also jukeboxes and phonographs.
Oh,
so they compete in those areas, but there's a particular rocket, I think it's the .275, a weapon used in Vietnam, that one does provides the fuel for, and the other assembles them.
I remember they play music as they drop
them. Right. It's like music to die by.
Yeah.
So they paid me for that, you know, and they never published it. And that was the end of that column for Rolling Stone.
And you never heard about it?
No.
Do you ever have a contract when you do? That's sort of like that article I did for The Realist, you know, that was going to be out in March and still isn't out, you know?
Oh, it does seem that way.
You kept the Nixon article off the shelf. Are you really for working for Nixon?
It does. I'll bet a case probably could be made for me. Right? I was a yippie that didn't get indicted in Chicago.
Yeah.
I've kept your article under...
that article about Richard Nixon that's been sitting there all these months?
Well,
okay.
I've been too busy writing the title of my book.
The book, do you get, now that you have some advertising and stuff, do you get some bookstores that begin to carry it?
Oh, well, you know, you hope that a demand will build up. But see, what happens is that if there's not a sale of the hardcover,
yeah,
and the softcover figure, people, it wouldn't be a good seller. Although, you know, whenever I've spoken to colleges, people keep saying, when is it going to come out in paperback?
Well, some come out
right away. Of suppression, you know, they haven't arrested me for any kind of conspiracy, but they have, since all my earnings were from the outside, they can cut down on your income and force you, you know, divert your energy.
I know.
After I testified in the Chicago conspiracy trial, at that time I was making my living doing film reviews for Cavalier magazine.
Yeah.
And after I testified, three wholesalers informed the publisher that they wouldn't distribute the magazine as long as my name appeared in it.
Oh, really?
So, you know, this is like Mort Saul on his level, you know, losing the TV show he had in Los Angeles because he was talking about the assassinations.
I was reading something of Lawrence Lipton's in Free Press today that came in L.A. Free Press, and he was talking about the third world and people getting it together and dropping out. And one of the things you have to do if you're not a part of either party or system that's equally corrupt and is that you do drop off your economic, your livelihood is cut off because there's no other way. You have to be willing to live with that. That is part of the system to squeeze out. You know, mm-hmm. If you speak honestly and say what you think, they'll read it years later and they say, oh, it's brilliant, it's wonderful, like Lenny Bruce. But at the time you're saying, everyone wants to put stones, you know, or arrows in your body, and they hate you, you know, for saying it. And it's like you go in an elevator or a drugstore now and you hear the Beatles, you know, on the music, and it really gets me mad when you think how they were screaming and yelling at the Beatles, you know.
Oh, yeah, but on the other hand, you do what you do because you have to do it, you want recognition, but you kind of trust that you're putting pebbles in the stream and it's creating ripples. The most gratifying thing that happened to me in that area was... probably the most outrageous thing I published was the parts left out of the Kennedy book, which featured a scene in which Lyndon Johnson performed an act of necrophilia upon the corpse of Jack Kennedy on the plane that you talked about that was being kidnapping his body from...
Somebody wrote to KLRB once and referred to my program as a necrophiliac hour.
Oh, really?
So they must have remembered your article.
Well, no, I could be an independent judgment. But anyway, the point is that there were a lot of... It was written in such a way that a lot of people believed that to be literally true. And one of the people who believed it to be literally true was Daniel Ellsberg.
Oh, really?
And that was in 1967. Uh-huh. Now, he didn't immediately come out and change his position, change his direction. But that was one of the inputs. You know, in order for him to have believed that, he had to believe that Lyndon Johnson was crazy. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a fair assumption, unless you're practicing necrophiliac and you think that's a perfectly normal activity.
Otherwise...
You can even remain faithful to one corpse. You know, none of this promiscuous necrophilia. So, go steady.
All the way to Washington.
Right. So the fact that he believed it meant that in 67 he thought that the president of his country that he was working for was crazy, that was directing the policies of Vietnam that
he was
working for.
Well, he was reading the policies, so there was double reason to believe it.
Yeah, right. But that was one of the inputs that affected his consciousness that in the end... caused him to be part of what you and I both hope for is an epidemic of conscience. I mean, that's the thing that gives me hope. Dick Gregory tells me the CIA men come to him and give him information. Now that they hear this, they'll give him misinformation. But he says because they see the way things are going. As you've said on this program, I've heard you say that these kind of conspiracies are based on are done on a need-to-know basis. And as people began to put pieces of this jigsaw puzzle together, they can see this... these connections.
And I hope that they will surface. Incidentally, since the show last week and I talked about Louis Tackwood and in reference to the Watergate affair, Louis Tackwood was picked up by the L.A. Police Department and beat very badly, and he's in jail down there. I don't know anything about the charges. I was supposed to get a call over the weekend, and see what was happening. And he was one of the courageous people that worked 9 years in the police department and surfaced because Ellsberg surfaced. And then Larry Shears surfaced after that and talked about the Treasury Department plan to kill Chavez and Eldridge Cleaver. And more people now are speaking up. The latest man to surface was a fellow in New York City, the trial of the Harlem Four. They've had three trials and been acquitted, and the judge said you're going to do a fourth. And their chief witness came out this week in the New York Times and said, I lied every time through the trial to try and get those men convicted, that I was afraid of the police department, that they would kill me and threaten me. And I think that more people that speak up and hear about these things and are a part of these crimes and have a conscience, because I think we're going into an age of conscience. And I hope that people that have been sitting back on the side and have been part of these crimes will speak up. I really hope they will.
Because sometimes, as I said earlier, you know, people do it through their own filters. So it kind of stunned me a little bit when I moved. The first demonstration in San Francisco that I saw was last year when they had when labor finally got involved. But they had signs that said, the Vietnamese never froze my wages. You know, so they weren't doing it on any particularly moral level, really, but at least they were getting in.
But the people that have been witness to a crime, I noticed that Ellsberg had an ad raising money for his defense that came out. And one of the things he mentioned, speaking about Ellsberg, was that he was arguing about the executive branch of the government being secretive and that they had to come down on him and make a treason trial at this time. Because I'm reading in quotes, he said, the executive branch of government is afraid that if these men do not suffer for their act, other government servants may also follow their conscience. Oh, this is Ellsberg's attorney or chairman for the fund, Stanley Sheinbaum, raising money for Ellsberg and Russo. He said, they are afraid that other government servants may follow their conscience and reveal not military secrets, but political secrets, information improperly withheld from Congress and the American people.
Oh, it happens. This is how. You know, I'm sure you've... Have you heard over the past 4 years... you would have heard it from... You would have figured it out. But the rumor or the story about the RAND Corporation having an assignment from the administration to... figure out the ramifications of there not being national elections in 1972?
Oh, yeah, I have that in my files.
Oh, well, I...
All
right, well, I got that story originally in, I guess it was 69, right after Woodstock.
Did that break in The Realist?
Huh? No, I was afraid.
Really?
That
why?
I was going to get killed. So I just broke it at every possible thing. There was a meeting in New Mexico of the people who had put on Woodstock. And there were people there from Rolling Stone, which never carried it, but Look Magazine and excuse me, and Underground Papers.
Yeah.
I started talking about it there. I started talking about it on radio in New York. And John Mitchell once said something like, whoever started this rumor is going to get punished. I now admit it publicly. But it wasn't a rumor.
Okay,
it was a thing that had been told to me by one of the people that you're talking about who had...
access to the information and
was struck by conscience.
Okay, let's say right at this moment that John Mitchell's going to get punished now for some of the things he's done.
Yes,
there's a little justice in this world.
The category for that is returning karma.
Returning karma. Oh, if that's true, there's going to be a lot of karma going around. But the thing is that there are men at RAND that know a lot. There's a people at the Pentagon, and I hope there's just not enough of them. And a lot of people have said to me, there couldn't be a conspiracy in Dallas to kill John Kennedy because there's so many people involved that somebody would have talked. A lot of people have talked, but nobody listens. It's like Martha Mitchell saying, they gave me a shot or had stitches on my finger, I'm a prisoner. She's talking. People just don't want to hear what she's saying because then they become involved themselves and they're too lazy.
Well, I think it's also a kind of American chauvinism. You know, people can accept the idea that the CIA and the RAND Corporation could systematically set up a dictatorship in Greece and in Saigon, but not here. But you know, history, like Mid-Century Journey by William Shirer, has points out how the entire French press was bought.
One of the warning signals I really worry about, because I worry about McGovern staying alive and what's going to happen, you know, for a while. One of the bad signals was when Thu came out yesterday and said, we don't take McGovern seriously, and neither does Ellsworth Bunger, you know, the team down there. They don't take this seriously at all, the whole election. Well, when you think how that man could manipulate through so many assassinations and prison terms for his opponents. and do that phony rig thing, then not taking McGovern seriously means this is a phase that'll be taken care of. I think that's that description of the Miami nomination worries me.
Well, it also could mean that how else could he respond to somebody who's called him a corrupt dictatorship?
There was an article.
He has to say, I don't take it seriously.
One of the reasons, you talk about Conley traveling around all these different countries and what he's doing at this time. The foreign press, there was an article today, did you see it? All the different countries' their reaction to McGovern's nomination. And it said the foreign press has been so saturated with Nixon's trip and Nixon's, traveling around and his great relationships that they don't, not one of the countries they quote would take McGovern seriously, that they felt comfortable with what Nixon was doing. And I'm sure the Conley must be threatening a loss of dollars if their people didn't give some overt support to Nixon because they're just shaking. I was reading an article about the Swedish economy and all the different countries in Europe would have the dollar. It was in the paper last night. All the different countries are shaking. And that's a Nixon trick, like, really getting them nervous about what would happen if they got in. Like, I control the dollar, the European money, and the what they're doing to the pound, and in France, Germany, England, Italy, and even Switzerland. Switzerland said, now, if you want to put money in the bank, you're going to pay us 8% interest rate. The dollar is just really played around with in Europe, and this is going to continue. Conley's the money man. It's going to continue till November as a threat. Like he said to the Jewish vote, I have an article from the New York Times that if he doesn't get the Jewish vote, he after the election, he will ask that they give back the land they got in the Six-Day War and make Palestine an open city. I mean, that is the wheeling-dealing Nixon, the most awful, flagrant bargaining. I can't imagine his putting his cards out that open. Did you read that article? I was really...
It's like a... How can you call him an Indian giver without insulting the Indians?
that's nasty to say that.
You said you wanted to read something from an article that was published in The Realist back in June 1966. But let me give the background of that.
Yes.
It's by Eric Norden. And Norden wrote an article for me on the assassination of Malcolm X. And the reason he did that, he was inspired. There was a guy named Art Steuer, who was the press representative for Dick Gregory. And let me tell you a brief little story about that. When Gregory was in Watts, and he got shot in the leg trying to cool things down, and he didn't want to call the paper himself, so he called Art Steuer in New York, told him the details. And Art called the L.A. Times and said he was in the phone booth in the middle of Watts and gave him all the details.
Oh, wow.
So it became a front-page story, Dick Gregory hurt in Watts riot. And it was done by way of, by 3,000 miles. Anyway, Steuer wrote an article on the conspiracy theory that he figured out. He figured that Adlai Stevenson was assassinated.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And he wrote an article for The Realist. Well, it's easy for you to say, oh, yes, definitely.
Definitely. There's a chapter coming out of the festival.
You mean you could just make a tally sheet on the wall.
Yes, of course. That's my wallpaper.
But Eric Norden saw the article and thought it was satirical. He said,
really?
Now, wait, while I'm going to write about a real conspiracy, the assassination of Malcolm X and the cooperation of the New York Police Department with the CIA. So he wrote that, and then in February of 1966, he wrote an article in Liberation magazine called American Atrocities in Vietnam. And like you, I was still gung-ho then on sending out stuff. I had copies of the reprints of that article sent to every single congressman and senator and the president.
The atrocities, it was new to us. Yeah.
Right. That was in February of 1966. The only one who responded was Bobby Kennedy,
oh, really?
By the way. It was just a formal thank you letter, but at least,
he was still alive.
It was a buzz, if nothing else. And so Eric Norden had a piece he wanted me to publish called, he called it The Tender Tyranny of American Liberals. And I printed it as a supplement to an issue to maintain,
I ordered a whole bunch of them.
Uh-huh.
That was in 66. I just met Paul in 72, but I ordered a whole bunch of those. I mail them out to everybody, the supplement that you have.
Yeah, well, it surprised me in a way that it got the response. Mort Sahl read some of it on his TV
it's
show.
So far out, yeah.
And I guess I took it for granted, because I had met so many phony liberals. But I thought that probably there are a lot of people who haven't seen this kind of criticism of liberals in the publication that is thought of as left of center.
That's right.
So what are the parts that...
Well, the parts I sent for it, because this was in 1966, and it was called The Tender Tyranny of American Liberals, and my copies turned almost yellow. It goes, it's so old, it's 66 seems like a long time, Paul. But it goes into the political and spiritual bankruptcy of contemporary liberalism. That is, he said, just another sign of evidence of American decadence. And alongside of this article was one by Tom Brayton I brought in from June 72, talking about the alienation of American people, the rootless, valueless society without goals. And he compared America in 1972, this is Tom Brayton in June 72, as since the death of John Kennedy in 1963, that the country had lost all its norms and that something was wrong, that we're in a spiritual crisis in 72. So I go back to The Realist in 66, which is talking about that crisis, you know, and he said the liberals have functioned both as imperialism's Kiplings, like Schlesinger, Burns, and Lerner, and they sold horror on the intellectual marketplace with the elan of Madison Avenue. Then the article goes into liberals do not possess the virtue of most fanatics, which is loyalty. The grief of the libs at the loss of their young champion, that was John Kennedy, did not extend to a dedication to uncover the truth about his death. As soon as the indicators pointed not to a lone assassin, but a well-organized conspiracy within agencies of the federal government, including the FBI and the CIA, the liberals looked the other way. JFK could be mourned, but not avenged. Too many apple carts would be upset in the process. He said at the upper level of the liberal establishment, there was a desperate effort, conscience and cynical, to cover up all traces of the conspiracy and reassure the American people that all was still the best in the best of all possible worlds. And even before Kennedy's corpse had cooled, leading libs assured us that the assassination was nothing more sinister than the act of a lone lunatic and the alleged murderer's own rub-out in the Dallas jail, just a chance conversion on the scene of another madman, Jack Ruby. Then he referred to Earl Warren, the most egregious judicial fraud in recent history.
Egregious.
Egregious, is that what it is? It was trotted out to provide a convenient liberal fig leaf for the biggest cover-up since the investigation of Lincoln's murder. And within a year, his commission of right-wing political hacks, segregationist senators, and princes of industry presented the public with a safe, prophylactic version of the assassination the libs desired. The Warren Commission report itself, an incredible melange of lies, half-truths, omissions, evasions, and distortions, is the ultimate testament to a contemporary liberalism fully deserving the place alongside the Reichstag trial in the annals of politico-judicial mythology. Well, this is what you published in the Realist in 66, and that's about what it was and where it was. And you really had a lot of courage, because I take 8 papers a day. I was taking 60 magazines a month and 8 papers a day and going through everything from American Opinion to the Wallace paper I take, and right, left, and middle. And this article that you printed in The Realist was the most honest description of the people who let down Kennedy, who were pretending they wanted the country to be better. And then Tom Brayton of the CIA, who travels along with Salinger and McGovern and all the liberals, cries now that the country is morally bankrupt. And yet his whole organization was in on the thing.
Well, except, you know, to be devil's advocate about myself, when I first moved to California, went on a camping trip with some friends up in the Sierras and saw Gary Snyder, the poet. And he was talking about this guru who had said something like, if the possibilities are infinite, that means in all directions.
Yeah.
You know, that means if the possibilities for hope are infinite, that means the possibilities for despair also, you know, or for compassion, then the possibilities for sadism, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I'm in the middle of reading a book now called Neither to Laugh Nor to Weep, and it's a memoir of the Armenian genocide in which, for 27 years, it started in 1895, there were 2 million deaths, and another couple of million people were figuratively and often literally driven into the sea before Turkey had solved its Armenian problem.
Like Burundi now, yeah.
So, and there's a comment here that his warning essentially is that when governments forget that they are dealing with human beings, not abstract problems, the results can be horribly inhuman. So one would suspect that somebody with all your knowledge would be filled with despair rather than have any sense of hope. Now, in that kind of historical perspective, you know, where violence is thought of as part of the human condition.
Yeah.
You know, and the Book of Job is supposed to be eternal in that context. You know, how come you still have hope?
I'm very optimistic. In fact, somebody was over, I forget it was this week, and said, you're always so optimistic, you know, about what you do, your enthusiasm. It was a researcher I talked to on the phone long distance, somebody, and they said, you're always so optimistic, you know, where they're really always down. Because, well, first of all, I don't believe in original sin. I don't believe that people are born evil or bad, and I think that's a heavy trip, the Judeo-Christian, the Christian.
I'm not one or the other. I'm talking about yin-yang.
Well, I have my own.
I'm talking about you can't have the concept of goodness without the concept of badness to be relative to.
Well, I think the badness is a question of interpretation and perversion, that there's no such thing as being born bad, and that people are born good. And if you get the climate right for them to nurture their goodness, the goodness is stronger than the bad. I think the bad is a heavy trip put on. I don't think it's born in you. And I think you have a climate, when you have a climate or a condition where the real you unfolds, the real you will be peace-loving. I did this, you know, like with my own children. I had certain goals that I wanted. You know, I had 5 children, and I said, how do you make them not destructive or loving or accepting? In this world, I'll have this will be my own clinic, my own nursery or greenhouse of my own children. And by not preaching or so forth, can I create people that are decent human beings? And if that works, the systems I use, I'd write about someday. And maybe other people will be able to use those too. And they've grown up. The youngest is 10 now. The others are adults. And I think they're decent human beings. They don't even want to hit a fly in the house. And it's not because I've said, oh, don't hit flies. It's just built in. The motors are built in. And I think it's consideration when they're little, and the decency that's in a human being, if you treat them decently, the climate is there. And all of this violence, the provocateurs, the killings, are put-ons, the religion. You talked about religious wars, the fact that Goebbels was into religious thing and still was sadistic. Well, what is the Inquisition or the Crusades?
No, but I didn't say religion. I said Gurdjieff. Yeah. There's a lot of people who think
but the mystical, the organized religions we have today, the worst radicals, the extremists, right wing, are the religious fanatics. You know, they take their religion and then go out and kill.
Oh, I think it has to do with organized religion. The fact that it's organized is therefore a means of control.
Yeah. Well, I'm optimistic every day because I feel that the good is going to take over the bad, that the bad is just a phase that can't go on, and no matter how many weapons and devices they have for following or data banks or control, that as soon as people understand their own value as human beings, like, I don't have more information, I'm not smarter than somebody else, they just haven't brought out their own potential.
You do have more information.
Well, I have information, but they have the potential to have that same information. I spent the evening last night with somebody who was brought up, kicked around in our society, who is black, who is fought in the streets with guns and things. And I tried, you know, to say, look, tools and information is so much better than weapons. And let's pull our heads and all work together and use the brains that they don't think you're supposed to have and you've got. And we'll all make it together. We're all one family. It's a family of man. And I'm optimistic that that message is going to spread because that's the truth. And truth lives, and their lies, and the lies of hatred or racism or people being different from each other is a lie.
Oh, yeah, it's not
and in time.
It's just another way of expressing, I guess, what Huey Newton said. The quote is, the spirit of the people is greater than the man's technology.
Absolutely, and today with the radio and cassette and there's few programs like this, but we're here. And people make tapes, and they spread them information all over the country, like WBAI New York. There's a lot of good stations in San Francisco, L.A., and Underground Press, and things that you put out in the Realist, like this thing that's been going even now in 13 years. You print some truths, and the Realist is still living. Look Magazine folds up, and the Realist is still going. I mean, it's just one of those things. You tell them the truth, and it's small, but it spreads. I mean, a lot of people... You're in the California area now. Whenever I mention your name, people are really surprised that you're out there. Your name is well known. They all know you. And the truth lives. No one is going to remember we even owned the Look magazine. See, I mean, that's just come and going because it was half lies, half truth. And if you just keep giving them what you really
think. Well, I'm half lies, half truth, but I admit it.
No, but you're
see, I just want everybody to be as suspicious of the mass media as they are of me.
You're not talking down to people like they're idiots. You're trying to tell them with a little tongue-in-cheek some of the sad things, some of the good things, and let them play with their gray matter and brains, which isn't what the media want.
Well, I think in that sense, because you and I are both editors in a sense, you know, you edit the material that you come in contact with, and I think that the condescension factor is what's lacking in us, I hope.
Yeah.
Because every editor I've ever known always talks about us and them. You know, but I'm one of them, and I just want to share the stuff that turns me on, that's what you.
Well, listen. Thanks for coming to visit. I had a.
Oh, we could have another
maybe next Saturday.
Of mutual compliments. When I discovered you.
Okay.
You were just a
nothing.
An incipient necrophiliac.
Okay. This is
KLRB in Carmel, and this is Paul Krasser, and I've been talking to Mae Brussel, and she'll be back again next Saturday at 4:00.
Thank you for coming.
We're going to say goodbye to Mae Brussel and Paul Krasner and continue on with music here. This is KLRB FM in Carmel.